On December 7th, 1941, many U.S. servicemen were either still in their pajamas or eating breakfast in the mess halls when the attack on Pearl Harbor began. The Japanese hoped to destroy the U.S. planes on the ground in order to minimize any counterattack against them over Pearl Harbor as well. We're going to be back more with Douglas Dietrich in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Douglas Dietrich with us. We're going to take your phone calls this hour as we talk about Pearl Harbor. Douglas, as this evolved, I want to ask you about things that were happening here in the United States while that war, that battle was going on. They were literally picking up and locking up citizens of Japanese ancestry in this country and putting them in camps, weren't they?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that impacts us to this day domestically, because all of the Japanese who were here had been here for many generations, at least three generations.
They were Americans, right?
Yes, they were all U.S. citizens, and what happened was their civil rights were violated on a mass scale, per the words of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, declared in force on January 26th of 1868. All persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the U.S. and the states where they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge their privileges and or immunities or deprive life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Now, in 1942, right after Pearl Harbor, martial law was not declared and the civil statutes were still in force. Yet 124,000 U.S. citizens of Japanese ancestry were deprived of their liberty without due process of law. They were certainly denied the equal protection of the laws, and they were deprived of all the real estate and financial property without adequate compensation. That adequate compensation was never given to them, because if you take a look at old official maps of the San Joaquin Valley of California, which is breadbasket to much of the world and could feed much of the world's population by itself, that used to officially be called Jap Valley on American maps. All of that land was stolen and sold to Caucasian landowners for pennies on the dollar. It was a giant land grab. And the cause of Japanese Americans was the cause of every U.S. citizen, still is today, because the constitutionality of that evacuation was unfortunately later upheld by the Supreme Court decades later in one of the strangest and most ambiguous decisions ever handed down by that tribunal. And because of that extremely dangerous decision, no minority group in this country is really safe today. And Caucasians are a minority in many parts of the United States. And no individual is safe from federal search, seizure, and impoundment. Long before the NDAA, basically under certain conditions, none of us were safe from unexpected detention and incarceration because of this action. So at that point, U.S. citizenship ceased to have any meaning. U.S. citizenship at that point meant that all you're expected to do is pay your taxes, and anytime they want, they can take everything.
Well, how long did they keep people, interned throughout the entire war?
Until ceasefire, Pacific ceasefire. The war did not legally end until the Treaty of San Francisco, signed at the Presidio Military Base where I worked, went into effect, which was April 28th of 1952. Until that point in time, Japan and the United States were legally at war. But back at Pearl Harbor, you had men who were fighting and dying for reasons they didn't even know about. I was mentioning all of the pilots who got shot down by friendly fire. Many of them were shot down out of their parachutes. There was one Army captain, Brookie Allen, who had flown a B-17 all the way from the West Coast to Hawaii, got there on an empty tank. They refilled it again so he could get back in the sky, and he escaped destruction by taxiing his B-17 away from the flight line at Hickam. He rose alone into the afternoon sky with orders to search for the Japanese carrier.
A true hero.
Yes, he found a carrier, and it turned out it was the USS Enterprise, and Halsey ordered his men to kill him so that he wouldn't report that Halsey was sitting there with a fully loaded operational carrier refusing to help his fellow servicemen. And this guy had full fire of the Enterprise opened up on him, and only by severe evasive maneuvers could he escape. He had almost been killed by Halsey.
But he got away.
He got away to report it. And that was totally hidden and covered up. Another UDT, underwater demolitions team expert, these were the Navy frogmen, the precursors to the Navy SEAL. In this case, Oris Olsen. Oris Olsen was ordered to dive down with many other salvage divers after the Pearl Harbor attack to see if there was anything they could salvage. They would hear all the sailors trapped inside the bulkhead.
Oh, my God. Still?
Yeah, tapping out SOS for weeks. for weeks, and they were ordered, given specific orders, you will not do anything to cut a hole with your acetylene torches in those bulkheads to rescue those servicemen, because they didn't want any witnesses. See, all those ships were chained together, and if the Japanese weren't going to take them out, the Americans sure as hell were. They were loaded with charges preset to sink them all. These were World War I dreadhulls that wouldn't last through another war, and they were loaded with all the youngest swabbies. You can take a look at all the men who died at Pearl Harbor. Every single one of them was under 18 years old.
Yeah, they were all kids.
Yeah, they were all
most
kids.
Most of them.
They gave them a big party before that night, so because they knew that the majority of them would die the next day. All of the World War I veterans or China Gunboat Patrol veterans like my dad were out to sea at the time of Pearl Harbor, because they needed their war-winning experience and their war-fighting experience to carry them through the next war. The submarines were gone.
Why didn't so? After this was done, Douglas, and then we're going to take some calls. After this war was over, did anybody? You weren't around. Did anybody challenge the official story?
The people who challenged it were derided as quacks, because a lot of times they didn't have access to the documents that I had access to. While I was a DOD research librarian, I did my best as a documents destruction specialist to release some documents that ultimately made it to the public. One of them was JB-355. JB-355 was serialized as both 591 and 691 in documentary status to confuse future retrieval attempts. And the acronym JB referenced Joint Board, which was equivalent to TJ's Joint Chiefs of Staff. That meant that this plan was both reviewed and recommended by scores of responsible contributors, including Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, as well as General Hap Arnold of the U.S. Army Air Corps. Now, this is the very act of conspiring to make war for which the United States intended to prosecute Axis national heads of state come 1945-46. The document was titled Aircraft Requirements for the Chinese Government and explicitly planned the bombing of Japan by Chenault Flying Tigers flying out of Chuzhou, Songzhou, and Hinchou to attack Nagasaki, Osaka Kobe, and Tokyo, respectively. And on July 22nd of 1941, per direct presidential authorization, Lachlan Currie cabled General Chenault to mobilize his criminal mercenary wing and basically conduct a falsely flagged bomber offensive with 66 bombers to be delivered in-country, China Command. And July 23rd in 1941, this conspiracy was authorized and signed into executive order by FDR himself, thereby implicating President Roosevelt as the preeminent war criminal of the 20th century. Now, on July 25th
That's
of 1941...
Pretty strong words, Douglas.
Well, they're a fact. 5 months before Pearl Harbor, the first 24 Lockheed Hudson bombers arrived in China while the U.S. Army Air Corps was relocating the entire 19th Bombardment Group based out of Hickam Field, U.S.-occupied Hawaii, to the Philippines. They were sending many more bombers to bomb Japan from out of China. These weren't just the Lockheed Hudsons. These were B-17D.
Douglas, have we learned anything from this? Or are we still making these same mistakes?
Well, the primary result of this war was that they learned that false flag operations work.
They work, and they work well, sadly enough.
They continued to carry them out all the way from the Tonkin Gulf incident through many other incidents that have occurred since then, almost like the USS Vincennes. It's important to emphasize the fact that that's one of the reasons why all the B-17D Flying Fortress heavy bombers were caught on the tarmac, not just at Clark Field in Luzon on the day of the Japanese simultaneous attack on the Philippines, but at Pearl Harbor's Hickam Field itself, because these were all either, in the case of the Philippines, loading up with ammo and fuel so that they could attack Taiwan, or in the case of Hickam Field, they were all empty and without any ammo because they were awaiting shipment to China so that they could bomb Japan from China.
Let's take some calls here for you, Douglas. They're lining up. We'll go first to Avila in Indiana, east of the Rockies. Eric, go ahead.
Good morning, George.
Hi.
I'd just like to, I guess you already stole my thunder because I was going to ask if Roosevelt knew about it. But is there anything that could be done about it now, or are you going to be labeled a kook in this regard? I'm just disgusted by everything I've heard about this whole thing.
Yeah, well, that's because it's disgusting. Well, there's no way to label me a kook because everything that I say is incontrovertible. For example, on July 26th of 1941, the reason I kept bringing up the money, concurrent to this general in-theater mobilization in Asia, FDR froze all of both Japan's and China's assets in the United States throughout the U.S.-dominated Western Hemisphere. Now, it's important to remember the largest Japanese population in the world outside of Japan, both then and now, is in Brazil. This was a devastating act of war in and of itself. This was far more than just a trade embargo. It eviscerated all of Japan's laboriously accumulated international monetary reserves. See, by 1941, war across the globe had congealed all of the financial systems of all the world's powers into autarky blocks, rendering their currencies incontrovertible. And abroad, the yen itself was suddenly rendered illiquid, that is, not acceptable for payments outside of the Japanese empire. Mm-hmm. The United States stood in this extraordinary position of controlling nearly all the world's negotiable monetary resources, and it abused this extraordinary power to bankrupt the entire nation of Japan with malevolent intent to devastate any Japanese ability to counter-mobilize its own national economy to respond to America's planned bombing offensive.
Douglas, after the war, after they signed the peace treaty on the USS Missouri, what were the relations with Japan? I mean, how soon did they begin to heal? I mean, nowadays, you wouldn't even think we were at war, strangely enough. But how soon did that happen?
Well, Japan went through its period of poverty, but they demanded a lot of immediate compensation from the United States. It's important to remember that what occurred on the USS Missouri was a ceasefire. It was not even legitimately a ceasefire. It was essentially a proactive cessation of prosecution of hostilities, and that's exactly how it was termed. In terms of what the Japanese demanded, they began to demand a lot of compensation from the Americans. It was Americans who were sent in to clean up Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Ultimately, many Americans died of radiation.
I did not know that.
Yes, that's quite true. The Americans, for instance, killed every single pig on the island of Okinawa. The Okinawans, unlike the Japanese, eat meat, specifically pork. And until the end of the war or the ceasefire, Japanese did not eat pork. Did not eat meat at all, but the Okinawans did. Now, in order to exterminate them during Operation Iceberg, the invasion of Okinawa, what happened was the Americans killed every pig on the island of Okinawa. The Japanese demanded a repopulation of the pig supply so that the Okinawans wouldn't starve during the winter. So every single pig on the island of Okinawa to this day is an American pig. I mean, that's one of those ironic settlements the Japanese had. They demanded all American carriers be turned over to Japan so that Japan could convert them into automobiles. And this was done. My father was part of a group of American sailors who protested, and they were able to rescue just a few of the American carriers as floating museums. But you can take a look at the basically the trail of salvage of American carriers that were used in World War II, and the overwhelming majority of them went to Japan for industrial conversion.
I did not know that either. Man, you are a wealth of knowledge. Don in Oahu in Hawaii, west of the Rockies. Hey, Don, go ahead.
Aloha. Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm a third-generation Japanese. I'm proud of it. My dad was a Nisei soldier in the 442nd Regiment Combat Team.
Yes.
He went to World War II. He joined them as a volunteer. He served his time, came back. He raised a family. And it's saddening to see what has happened, you know, during this war, but it was amazing what he did, and I'm glad that I'm here today to be able to prosper and be a good citizen and whatnot. I can't believe what they did to the number of Japanese ancestry people to round them up and put them in internment camps. I went to Europe in 2002 with the 100 and the 442nd Regiment and Battalion team with their veterans and their families. My dad died in 2000 in a tragic accident.
Sorry to hear that.
And he was at a reunion for 442nd here in Hawaii. He was run over by a fellow veteran in the parking lot.
Oh.
They were his best friend from high school was a veteran also with him, and they were killed instantly. The driver we forgave, you know, he was a fellow veteran. We didn't know him, but we forgave him. But, you know, I've been to Europe. I've seen what they did, the battles, the cemeteries, the things that they did for the country to prove their loyalty. And I did go to the concentration camp in Dachau, in Munich, Germany, and I've seen what they did to the Jews and whatnot. And it's amazing what the Holocaust was all about also. But I just want to say that I'm proud to be Japanese. I'm only half, but I'm proud to be, and I'm very loyal to this country. And I just appreciate what my dad and all the other men did in the war did for this country.
All right, thank you. I'm sure this time period brings back some deep-seated emotions.
Yes.
And for you too, Douglas, there's no question. I mean, I've known you for years. You are very passionate about this topic.
Yes. Yes, very much so, because I think it's so important for Americans to give up all of their delusions concerning this being a good war or a war which ended with atomic weapons. That was not the case. By Title 38, under citation of the U.S. Code, which is the law as created by Congress, the ceasefire did not occur until December 31st of 1946. And the Code of Federal Regulations, which is law, again, equivalent to executive orders that enforces Title 38, also agrees that any veteran seeking damages for injuries suffered during wartime is allowed to do so if a World War II veteran were still alive and wanting to pursue this up until December 31st, 1946. This is the kinds of complexities that I could go into as someone who's familiar with bureaucracy at great length that most Americans are unfamiliar with, but they need to come to grips with the fact that what happened on the USS Missouri was simply a propaganda act. The Japanese had no swords to surrender. The Americans were flying an illegal flag that was not only mounted backwards, but had 31 stars, a transposition of the number 13. We had 48 states in the Union at the time. Every single one of those stars was upside down in the shape of a satanic pentagram. This can be just confirmed by photographically. It's undeniable. It's not a negative reversal, because a negative reversal does not turn singular elements upside down.
What was the significance of doing that, Douglas?
It was because it was an illegal ceremony. It was simply done for the sake of the camera so the American public back home could have something to celebrate. The American public was tired of the war. They needed a morale boost.
Sure.
President Truman was willing to give them one, and I couldn't blame him for that. But it's important to remember that the very words surrender, capitulate, failure, and defeat are entirely absent from the Japanese Imperial Rescript as officially translated by the United States and reflecting literally the Japanese original. And this was published in both Japanese and English on page number one of the Nippon Times on the 15th of August in 1945.
Douglas, there's always talk now that Taiwan could be a takeover target by the Chinese. Would we step in under treaty, we're supposed to defend Taiwan?
Well, I highly doubt that the Americans would step in, depending on the situation. During the Clinton administration, he did send a carrier task force in there to sail the Taiwan Straits, and he did this because the Taiwanese were able to pay him a bigger bribe than the communist Chinese were. That was literally how it worked. That was one of the reasons why they had so many Taiwanese monks dealing with Al Gore. That is at the level of diplomacy that we are at today.
All right.
But it's important to remember that Taiwan can readily take care of itself. It has an atomic arsenal that no one can do anything about because it's not recognized by the United Nations. Therefore, UN inspectors are not allowed inside of Taiwan.
Douglas, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with final phone calls for you. Douglas Dietrich's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's got a few books out, by the way, Roswell and the Rising Sun and Satan's Crusaders as well. And, as I mentioned earlier, he was a document destroyer. We'll talk about how he did that and take your calls when we come right back. I'll have open lines for you next hour, and we'll have final phone calls with Douglas Dietrich when we come back in a moment. 10 days free, our television program with Guyam TV. That's what you can get. 10 days free by simply going to coasttocoastam.com. There's a video excerpt link there that you'll see under the highlights reel. And just click that and take it away. You will also have access, by the way, while you're doing this, to our TV show, which debuts on December 14th, next Friday. But also, there are hundreds and hundreds of incredible videos and DVDs. So take advantage of that. Go to coasttocoastam.com or think of this website, guyamtv.com/George. I'll have to spell it for you, guyamtv.com/George. Douglas Dietrich with us. Douglas, when you were a defense research librarian, and of course one of the duties, document destruction, what kind of documents and why destroy them?
Well, the San Francisco Presidio Military Base was not just the U.S. Army's 6th Army headquarters. It was also the Western Defense Command Center in World War II. This made it responsible for all 17 of the western states of the United States, as well as Hawaii under its general command. And it was also the source for many of American deployments to South American nations for banana wars throughout the 1930s, the Vietnam War, the Korean War. Many documents such as that were there that they were simply making room within the facility by destroying them. It wasn't even a conspiracy in most cases of trying to hide or obfuscate information. The tragedy was that most academics or journalists really weren't interested in these documents. They were happy with the myth that had been fed them. And I took down copious notes. I smuggled out as many documents as I could, got them to researchers concerning things such as illegal atomic testing, which would take a whole nother show to describe, various subjects which I felt were just priceless to history, like the JB-355 document that I mentioned.
Yeah.
But in terms of the kinds of documents that were destroyed, it's important to emphasize that the United Nations was founded at the Presidio Military Base, was founded there in January 1st of 1942, 3 weeks and 3 days after Pearl Harbor, before they even really began to intern so many Japanese Americans, as well as a lot of Italian and German Americans that were interned that many people don't know about. But the point about the United Nations is it's important to remember it was founded per Title 42 of the United Nations Charter as an organization of war. In lieu of a Constitution, they have a charter. Their primary function during the Second World War was to orchestrate resistance armies behind Axis-occupied lines. There's actually a United Nations battle flag. You can look this up. It is a white field with four vertical stripes to represent Roosevelt's four freedoms. I'm painfully aware of all the intricacies of this because, as I said, the nation in which I was born, the Republic of China, was one of the founding members of that establishment and yet was later on ejected from it to make room for the communists. And again, that was part of Roosevelt's legacy. It's important to remember another legacy of his was American energy dependence on other nations. Before World War II was legally declared, the United States was the Saudi Arabia of the world. 95% of all of Japan's oil supply came from the United States, and the United States cut off that oil supply to Japan again before the attack on Pearl Harbor. This would be the equivalent of OPEC cutting off all oil to the United States in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what had happened was the war basically caused the U.S. to expend all of its sweet light crude before we knew of the concept of abiotic war. The Allies got 7 billion barrels of oil, every single drop from the United States. It used 95% of its own proven reserves and left Texas as its major source until petroleum peak in 1971. Again, this is not to go into the abiotic oil
Understand.
We know now, but it's important to remember that this resulted in Roosevelt having to buy out the House of Saud from under the British Empire. So on February 14th of 1945, just before his death, he met with the king of the House of Saud on the Great Bitter Lake between the locks of the Suez Canal. And the king of the House of Saud knew he had Roosevelt by the throat. You can look these photos up in the National Archives. He brought a flock of sheep with him onto the USS Quincy, where Roosevelt held audience with him. And the king of Saud said, "These sheep are for your servicemen to copulate with so they do not defile our pure Muslim woman." And Roosevelt took it. That's how desperate he was. And it was at that point,
I would have escorted him off the ship.
Yes. At that point, Roosevelt agreed to peg the U.S. dollar onto the outflow of Saudi oil. That was what had happened because everyone else was pegged onto the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar itself was not pegged to anything. It wasn't pegged to gold, so Roosevelt agreed at that moment with the king of the House of Saud. He pegged it to the outflow of Saudi oil. That's what created the concept of the petrobuck. Nixon tried to take us off of that. Indeed, he did remove us from the Bretton Woods monetary system.
Right.
That's why they went after him. That's why they crashed his administration for reasons that today we would find absurd.
All right, to the final calls we go. We'll go to Sean, truck driving in Indiana, first-time caller. Sean, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you, George, for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time listener back to the Art Bell days.
Thank you, sir.
I want to thank you for your service to our country from one vet to another.
Thank you. You too.
And thank you for tonight's program because it goes right to my heart. My father was at Pearl Harbor on the USS Utah the day that it got hit.
Oh, my.
His survivorship was due to a plank. Mr. Dietrich made that very clear that there was planking. It was because of the plank that he survived. He also sat on that plank and watched a destroyer in the harbor launch depth charges at a two-man Japanese sub that, from what I understand, is mounted this day in the harbor.
Right.
Unfortunately, my father died last year at the age of 92.
Mine died last year, too, strangely.
Yeah, and my condolences to you, too, George. But he did have a long, happy life and related many stories as I grew up as a kid in our household.
And you will remember them forever, Sean. Thank you so much. You know, how many World War II veterans are left, Douglas?
Not nearly enough. We have to remember that even though 27 million men were mobilized for war in the Second World War, two-thirds of them draftees. Unlike the Vietnam War, the numbers were just the opposite. During Vietnam, two-thirds of the men serving in-country Vietnam were volunteers, and only one-third were draftees. World War II, two-thirds were draftees and one-third were volunteers. My father was one of the first volunteers before the Second World War, and it's important to remember because there were so many of them, they're dying at the rate of 1,000 a day. So there's not nearly enough of them left, which is why it is such a godsend that Mr. Norrie, a solid Navy man himself, acknowledges the importance of this issue by allowing me to expose why these men died before all of them die. And that is a favor for which you are forever blessed, Mr. Norrie. I want to thank you very much for what you're doing.
Well, Douglas, thank you. Would we ever have entered the war against the Nazis had we not been attacked by the Japanese?
You know, that's a very important point. Well, thank you very much for bringing that up. America did not declare war on the Third Reich. Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States because of what the Americans had done with the monetary system. Adolf Hitler knew that he would be next. See, Japan had ample liquid assets, dollars in U.S. banks and gold bars in Tokyo vaults, that it was using to pay the relatively small international debts incurred by the China War and combating the illegal insurgency the Americans were conducting via Chenault's Flying Tigers. Japan was not insolvent, but FDR's penstroke rendered the entire nation of Japan illiquid. The freeze isolated Japan economically from the outside world, voiding its monetary assets, both sums on hand or obtainable in the future. Consent to buy strategic goods within the U.S.-dominated Western Hemisphere or in any country that exported for dollars was withheld by the United States in conjunction with parallel freezes simultaneously initiated at FDR's insistence by the British and Dutch colonial empires that controlled enormous areas of the Asian Pacific hemisphere surrounding Japan. And they referred to this as the ABCDE squeeze box, which was an acronym for the American, British, Chinese, and Dutch East Indies economic stranglehold intended to bring Japan to its knees while American bombardment commenced. But it's important to remember that freezing the Chinese assets simultaneously blocked Japan's access to the outside world through the Shanghai Stock Exchange and the international market via Shanghai's ports. This also condemned millions of Chinese to starvation via imposition of indiscriminate sanctions.
So Adolf made a big mistake declaring war on us.
Well, not really, because his advisors told him he would be a fool to declare war on the United States, but he said, look at what they're doing economically. We'd be fools not to. And he actually extended the life of his regime by declaring war because he got his nation on a military footing of total war mobilization underneath Reich's propaganda minister, Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, by the declaration against the United States, which otherwise his regime would have been bankrupted as Japan's was at the start of the war, and he would have had to have backpedaled enormously without the kind of funding that he would otherwise have had access to immediately. And that was the reason why he did what he did, what otherwise would look irrational. But in America's case, what had happened was when it basically did what it did to the Chinese, it's important to remember there were three republics in China, the Communist Republic, the Nationalist Chinese Republic, into which I was born, and the Imperial Republic that had been established by a warlord named Yuan Shikai.
And Chiang Kai-shek had the second one, right?
That's correct. Okay. And a warlord by the name of Yuan Shikai had established the Imperial Republic in 1915. This later on became the largest republic of the three Chinese republics because it had the most population based in it. It collaborated with the Japanese, and it's never spoken of by the communists or the nationalists, but it was the largest republic of its time in China. It declared war against the United States along with Japan on December 7th, 1941, as did Emperor Bao Dai of Vietnam, the Emperor of Thailand and Emperor Puyi of Manchuria, and several other Asian allies. Japan was not alone in its war against the United States. Neither was Germany. Along with Germany declaring war on the United States after Pearl Harbor, so did Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, also independent Croatia, and a number of other nations within the European dominated.
Douglas, do you see a third world war ever popping up again?
I feel that we already had one. It was what the Americans propagandized as the Cold War. This was a war in which millions of people died on massive static superfronts, similar to World War One. The World War One trenches took up all of France. The Korean and Vietnamese demilitarized zones were much thinner, but millions of people died fighting communism. Also in Afghanistan, we had massive superfronts, and the Soviet Union ultimately collapsed due to this war effort. Future historians will acknowledge that as the Third World War. It lasted half a century, and it took the Soviet Union down without invasion in the same manner that the Kaiser's Imperial Germany was taken down without invasion. And so that will ultimately, I believe, be acknowledged by history. If any war comes up, it will be a Fourth World War, it will be a religious war, and it will be fought between mainly Islam and Christianity and other belligerent religions in a new dark age that we are entering today. But with your kind permission, sir, with what little time we have left, I was wondering if I could tell people about the website. And
oh, absolutely. And then we'll take final calls.
Yes, sir. I want people to check out DouglasDietrich.com. Again, that's www.Douglas, spelled with one S, Dietrich, just like the famous actress Marlene Dietrich, who's a distant relative of mine. For those of you too young to remember how to spell her name, just put the words diet and rich together. So DouglasDietrich.com is where you'll find our holiday DVD deal, and that is Roswell and the Rising Sun. I do hope that people will check into that, because I came home from producing that, and the one day I had to do it to find my mother dying, I called George Norrie up and asked that she be put on the prayer line because of the condition I found her in. It was a very mysterious and suspicious death. The doctors had never seen anything like it. So let's make sure her death is not in vain by checking that out. We're selling two DVDs for the price of one through the holiday season while we have them left. The other one is Satan's Crusaders. Roswell and the Rising Sun is going to be discontinued because we're going to analog that into text form and publish it as a book with illustrations that are easier to see. And Satan's Crusaders, of course, talks about my time where I was assigned liaison responsibilities as a DOD research librarian to the U.S. Army's officially recognized satanic chaplain, Colonel Michael Aquino, for almost a decade. And I do want people to check into my radio shows if they have the time. They start before the Coast to Coast time slot. And you can catch them, Critical Omissions, on Tuesdays when I have a guest. It's 10 to midnight Eastern. And Saturday Night Firing Lines is when I do nothing but take 2 hours of open calls. And that's 10 to midnight Eastern on Saturday nights. So you can check out Saturdays and Tuesdays at freedomslips.com. From Freedom's Lips to your ears, or just remember, freedomslips.com, easier to spell. And finally, Nexus Magazine, which is not allowed to circulate in the United States, basically has interviewed me for three very long articles on the thousand-year Reich in exile. And they're a very good magazine to check into. And they will be doing another article based on my interviews and their transcripts in the very near future. So thank you so much, Mr. Norrie, for allowing me to bring all of that up.
There you have. Let's go to Port Chester, New York. Mark, let's get you in here. Go ahead, Mark.
Wow, I don't know where to begin. Mr. Dietrich, you're doing God's work. I'm going to visit your website, and you should write a book. Your knowledge is absolutely incredible. My great-uncle, Marco Antonio, came off the boat from Italy. He fought in World War One. I had an uncle at the Battle of the Bulge and in the Ardennes Forest, and my father, God rest his soul, was in Korea. You know as well as I do that we didn't have to fight the wars that we fought. There's so much information you came through. They took 500,000 tons of arms and munition, if not more, and they dumped it into Vietnam and Korea, where my father served after World War II. This just keeps on going. I mean, you're absolutely right. You're not a kook. We know that FDR, the Delano family selling the drugs, the opium. George, I've been listening to you for years. I am disgusted with my government, but I don't know where else to go, George. I was in tears of hearing about the guys banging on the bottom of the hulls of the ships. I was literally in tears. I almost hung up the phone. It doesn't stop. We got guys in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're getting their limbs blown off. What are we fighting
for? It's all about money. It's always about money.
But the progressive, the movement, there were, I told the call screener, there was another, it was a secular Jewish fellow who was in Roosevelt's administration. He was also a Soviet spy. Alger Hiss was the spy. He mentioned the Verona Papers. And people still defend Alger Hiss. Whitaker Chambers exposed him. Joseph Trento wrote a book, The Secret History of the CIA. The Soviets have been cleaning our clock, but we've been working with them. You know what? We can go, Mr. Dietrich. I just want to say God bless you, and I'm disgusted, George. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people, when they hear stories like this, Douglas, do get disgusted, like he did, like Mark did.
Right. Well, I mean,
and it's not about the country.
Yeah.
It's about those who are in power.
It's so true. A good example of that would be the man who's known as the father of the atomic bomb, General Leslie Groves. In power circles, he's not recognized for that. He's known as the man who built the Pentagon. And the ground was broken for the Pentagon. The dirt turned under spade, driven to the ground by the foot of General Leslie Groves himself to celebrate commencement of construction of the largest office building in the world on September 11th, 1941, 56 days before Pearl Harbor. The contract to construct the Pentagon totaled $31,100,000 World War II dollars. And basically, he said, we're going to start the biggest war the world has ever seen. We're going to need the biggest office building the world has ever seen from which to manage it. And because we need all the steel for tanks and guns and planes and ships, it's going to be all concrete. They didn't even use steel for elevator cables. There's no elevators originally in the Pentagon. It was all built with ramps, all concrete. And they cleared out a whole Hell's Bottom neighborhood, a slum with approximately 150 residences, just to make the Pentagon. They told all the people rendered homeless the men could enlist. That didn't help the women or the children. And then years later, on September 11th of 2001, on the 60th or 61st anniversary of the Pentagon, suddenly an office building that can hold almost 5,000 people is effectively empty. It's one of those things that you've got to ask yourself, how is that possible? And since it was all concrete, it had no abutments to prevent it from collapsing if a plane were to crash into it. And yet the fifth wing of the Pentagon, the one facade that they suddenly reinforced with steel beams and sprinklers, suddenly that's
the one
that gets hit.
Douglas, thank you so much for being on the program this anniversary of Pearl Harbor, 71 years. I'll be back in a moment. We've got open lines now for the next couple hours right here on Coast to Coast AM.